Got it.
Okay. Namaste and welcome to another satsang. And it's good to see some of our people that weren't here back again. And I hope things go as well as possible for your son. So, yeah. If there's anything we can do, let us know. Okay. And other people that are new, that are returning, nice to see you here again. Thank you for coming. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get to the satsang bowl. And whoever's questions that we get here, go ahead and take the mic in case you have, or if somebody else has anything further to say on that, if you could let whoever is late in. I like the macrocosm working in the microcosm idea from the emails. Can you say more about this? Could you elaborate a little bit more on what emails?
I think it was someone else's email to you, and they were talking about the macrocosm influences the microcosm, and all you have to do is let go and be in the flow, and that you don't have to do anything, that it will all happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, when one is surrendered, then grace appears and you spontaneously flow. This is what I was talking again about a little bit last time, about one that's surrendered versus one that's in apathy, and which is not surrender, which is just not doing, which is not, you know, just stagnation. But yeah, if you're surrendered, you're going with the flow, and things will naturally adjust. It's just like the same when we say that you're already, you know, what you are seeking. There's always that seed of perfection in there. What needs to happen is let go of that which is covering it over. It's not that you're flawed and moving towards perfection. There's already perfection there, and the flaw is that which is covering it over. So you're not developing something new. It's already there. You just need to find that it is there. Okay? By letting go. Letting go. Letting go. Letting go. Okay? So we're not going to earn our way there. It's a process of letting go and surrendering and finding that it's already in place when we let go of the things that are hindering us, the things that have covered it over with seeming imperfection. We need the mic, please.
The Tao Te Ching says that the man of the Tao does not need to go anywhere or do anything. And just, you know, from your room, you can actually transform society just by being in your state of consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nowhere that you need to chase after. It's already right there, wherever you are. So same thing, you don't need to go on pilgrimage to sacred spots. If you're in a sacred state of mind, it's right where you're at.
Right, and that all is provided.
All can be provided. Yeah. The more you let go, the more grace appears. The more the way becomes clear. Okay. Okay, next question. Are Dianetics and Scientology helpful practices? It's supposed to be a way to discharge things. Okay. I've been to visit the people at Dianetics to ask them about their practices. Unfortunately, the people they have working the front desk don't know anything. They're there to sell. Of course, they don't know too much. So I asked them, you know, what is a clear? You know, what is well, somebody that's in liberation. What's liberation? Well, it's whatever you think it means. I said, what do they think it means? They go look it up in the dictionary. I said, I don't need to look it up. I said, if you're selling this, you should know what it is. What is it that they're proposing as a liberated being? How many clears are there supposed to be on the planet? Oh, only maybe 1,000, maybe. And how does one become clear? And is there any other way other than Dianetics? They go, no, there's no other way. I don't know of any other way. I said, it would behoove you to find out if there are other ways. Okay. So what they do is a process. You sit back and forth from each other, and you bring up something, and you keep repeating it over and over and over again until there's not a discharge from it. That's all. Well, look at it again. What else do you see with it? And they just keep adding to the story. Look at it again. What do you see from it? They add another piece to the story until it's no longer traumatic to talk about it. But you can do that endlessly. One story can beget another story, can beget another story, can beget another story. Okay? They're doing issue after issue after issue. Whereas if you're on this type of a path, issues are going to come up, but eventually you see all the issues revolve around an I, identity. I want, I desire, I don't want, I have an aversion to, me, my, I. Eventually you get it. Okay, what is this I? Then you start looking deeper at the root of it. What is this I? Namaste. What is this identification that holds us in place? So when you can get to the bottom of that and say, neti, neti, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, you start going deeper and look at, am I the mind? What is the mind? You find out it's not this. Am I the body? What is this body? You find out it's not that. You keep going neti, neti, not this, not this, not this, not this, until nothing is left but the absolute. Okay. And when through meditation, when you're drawn into the nirvikalpa, then that also gets rid of the last of these conditioned ideas that I am this body or I am this, you know, collected set of experiences. You're not the experiences. You're that which is aware of them. That's all. That which makes them possible. Okay. You're that which makes them possible to be, but you are not the experience itself. Because if you're seeing an experience, it's something separate from you. Okay. It's phenomena, it's movement, it's Shakti. You are that absolute, pristine, which is unmoving, unchanging. Okay. So this path is a little different than Dianetics, okay, than Scientology. It might be able to help some people with a few issues. I'll give them that. But to do a Dianetics path to become a clear would take you a very, very, very long time, and it's not going to happen until you really confront the end. What is this I? Okay. Because what needs to get out of the way is I and separation. Dianetics does not get I and separation out of the way. It just looks at that which is surrounding I, all the phenomena that I interacts with. Okay. Okay, next question. Can you talk about control and letting go of control? Yeah. People want to have control of things, and they think if they let go that they'll be out of control. But this is the paradox. If you need to control something, then you're already out of control. Hmm? Just like what you found out when you thought you needed to control the hair and you needed to control this stuff in order to do your work, you were basically out of control. But when you let go of that, then what happened? It's no longer an issue. You're more in the flow. It's a non-issue. So when you let go of this need to control, then you find out there was nothing that needed to be controlled. As long as you think you need to remain in control, then you're out of control. Even your own feelings. Yeah. Because if you sit and you do vipassana, or you just sit and watch it, the feelings, they come and go, they come and go, they come and go, they come and go. They're transient. Okay? So what are you going to control? It's going to come, it's going to go. It's going to come, it's going to go. There's nothing to control. If you're trying to control it, then what happens? You can't control it. It's transient. Right? So if you're trying to control something that's transient, you're going to have a very difficult time. If you're trying to control something that's flow, you're going to have a very difficult time.
So both external phenomena is transient, as well as internal phenomena.
Any phenomena is transient.
Yes. And if you don't try to control external phenomena, like in your daily life, then what is the factor for behaving with regards to it? Spontaneity?
Yeah, just be spontaneous in the moment. That's all. A realized being that doesn't sit and think about what am I going to say, what am I going to do, how am I going to act, how is this going to affect this, how is it going to affect that. It's spontaneous. That's all. There's nothing to think about anymore. It simply happens. Okay? It's flow. A flow is created.
And with that spontaneity, there is the factor of trust.
It's absolute trust. There's nothing to trust. It simply is. Okay? Trust is based on a hope. Okay? When it simply is, there's nothing to hope or trust about. It simply is. It's beyond trust. It's beyond hope. It simply is. It's the reality. There's no disputing it. In trust or hope, it's a possibility. Maybe it's this way. In knowing, it simply is. You know it is beyond a shadow of a doubt. So there's nothing that you're trusting. It just is, okay? I don't need to trust in it. Because for trust to exist, there must be some doubt somewhere. When there's no doubt, it just simply is.
And the desire for a particular outcome. And trust is involved with the desire for an outcome.
Any type of desire is what? Desire is suffering because you're trying to, you know, it's an expectation.
Exactly.
As long as you have expectations, what's going to happen? Expectations are not going to be met. Okay? But if you're open and you're going with the flow, it's always an adventure. Okay? It's always a miracle. You don't know what's going to happen next, and that's fine. That's the adventure. That's the fun of it. Okay.
Deepak Chopra would say that you can have the intention, and that's okay. It's not like you don't have intentions of where you're going, but that you just accept the moment as it is. This moment is as it should be.
You can have intention all you want. But one has to be surrendered to what comes.
Right.
Okay? You can have intention, but not be attached to what comes. Okay? You need to have some sort of an intention or something to make a direction start to take place. But the way that it flows from that intention one has to be surrendered and accepting of what comes. Okay? It's not a goal. You have an intention. You put that energy out there, and then you see which way it flows. And you go with the flow of it. Okay? Is that clear? Good. Okay. Next question. Om Namah Shivaya. What's the literal translation? Okay, Om Namah Shivaya. We have a Shiva break here in the midst of it. Well, that was interesting. I didn't know it was a question. But, okay, yeah. Omkara is the first sound, the first vibration of the universe, and any sound that you hear will have Om in the midst of it. It's the eternal sound. It's that first sound that brings creation into effect. Okay? This is why if you're doing Om, if you continue to just do Om, and that's the only mantra you do, eventually every sound you hear will sound like Om. Instead of hear a car going by going, you'll hear Om. Okay? Every sound will contain Om in it. Okay, so it will draw you into a meditation immediately. You can stay in a meditative state. Okay? Namaha. The name of, or Namaha is also like a respect, or I bow to you, or I surrender to you. Shivaya. Shiva is Shiva, and Shiva is basically consciousness. Okay, so I bow to that consciousness, that first vibration, which brings everything into effect, everything into play. Okay, I bow to that absolute. Okay, I bow and I surrender to that absolute, which is the foundation for all. It's that inner seed of who and what you are. Shiva, Parashiva. Parashiva is that which is beyond, another name for absolute. Like Kali. Kali is another name for the energy side or the phenomena side or that which you see. Shiva is that which you're not seeing, that seed where everything comes from. Okay? So it's just a way to surrender and to remember to surrender in that. Okay? How does one identify arrogance in oneself and get rid of it? Arrogance is when you're speaking about something that you really don't know. Just speaking about.
You have no direct experience.
No direct experience of it. Can only speak about really what you have direct experience about. Or if you think that speaking about something or entertaining something makes you superior to another one, someone else, that's arrogance. Okay?
Well, you repeat hearsay.
Doesn't matter. Hearsay or, you know, even if you're repeating or you're saying something that you think that you know, but you think it makes you higher than someone else, that's arrogance. Okay. Because there's no higher and lower. There's no higher and lower here. Okay? I'm guru, but I know that the seed essence of everyone is the same as what I am. Just because I'm speaking to you doesn't mean that I think you are lower. Because there's only that divine essence, only one. It's not mine versus yours. There's only one. So what is there to be arrogant about? There's nothing to be arrogant about. There's only one. There's not a higher absolute and a lower absolute down here. There's only one. And it's the same within all being. Okay. It's like one diamond and many facets. Are you going to be arrogant and think that this facet is higher than you are or lower than you are? Maybe if you're at the top facet up here and you're looking down, you say, oh, that facet's lower than me. But no, this is only one diamond, okay? You're all part of that same one whole. Okay, so there's nothing to have arrogance about. Each person comes in and has feelings, has emotions, has the same sort of feelings, emotions, same basic problems. Everyone, well, for the most part, I can't say everyone, because there are a few that come in wide awake when they come in and know that they're not the body and the form. But most of us go through a process to find out we're not the body, the emotions, or the form. And to do that usually takes quite a bit of suffering along the way to figure that out. Okay, so what is there to be arrogant about? Where you are, I have been. Okay. What should develop is more compassion. Because when you reach that end point, then you know that suffering is unneeded. Unneeded. One is free to not suffer, but you just don't know how to not suffer. Okay. So where can be arrogance? Instead of being arrogant, people should have more compassion. Instead of look at where I am, have compassion for the suffering of others. And hopefully that they will come out of their suffering. So if you want to get rid of arrogance, develop compassion. Know where you're at and the suffering you're going through, and see others in their suffering and have compassion. Be grateful if you're out of some suffering. But that shouldn't equate out to arrogance. It should equate out to thankfulness and gratitude that you're out of the suffering. Okay. How does one eliminate obsession with the health of the body and physical phenomena associated with it? I think we spoke a little bit about this last week or the week before about being the temple. The body's a vehicle, okay? It's a temple. Yes, you want to take care of it, but it's not who and what you are. When you confuse it with who and what you are, then you get overly ingrained in taking care of it, okay? Treat it as you would a vehicle, your car. You need to have regular maintenance on the car for it to work. Okay? You want to keep it clean. You want to keep it maintenanced. You know? But if you're going out there to, put the bouncers, the things to make it bounce and the real, really big fancy paint job on it, look at me, then you're overdoing it. Okay? Then you're overdoing it. Okay? Treat it like you would the temple. You go into the temple to find that sacred place to commune with the divine. Go within your heart center, commune with the divine. So treat it like that. Treat it as a sacred. Okay? As a sacred place. All right. Is that clear? Yeah. What is this, Samkhya?
Samkhya? That was Bob's question. He wanted to know if you...
Do you know the meaning of the word?
Not offhand. Not offhand.
Okay.
I'd have to look it up. I'm not familiar with all Sanskrit words. I'd have to look it up, and then I can comment on it. So we'll save this for another time. Thank you. Oh, is that how you fix that? I'm sitting here fighting with the mic the whole time, and all it took was this one little knob. So there it goes. Gurus are supposed to know everything in the universe. We know what matters, which is the absolute. But don't ask me how to fix this damn knob over here. Don't ask me who's going to win the next race. I don't know. Can you explain what you mean when you say we will become thoroughly familiar with our minds? Yeah, when you're going through the Kundalini experience, where are you living usually? In your mind. And when the Kundalini starts going, it starts unlocking all of the cellular memory. All this past stuff, all the stuff that's coming up. And you go in and you witness that and you start to see it. And you start to confront it. So you'll go through all these different layers, whether it has to do with survival, sex, you know, creating an identity, moving, expanding into compassion for others, you know, then speaking and knowing your own truth and, you know, layer by layer. On this journey, you wind up confronting all these things, anger, fear, and what holds it in place, which is this identity and identification with these things. So yes, by the end of the path, you know the mind inside and out because you've confronted every aspect of it. You've gone beyond mind. When you go beyond mind, then you can see exactly what mind is and everything that's connected with it, how it relates. It becomes very clear at that point. This is what I've told one person that's she's a psychologist and she's going through Kundalini. And I told her, now you're in the advanced psychology course. Because by the time you get through, you will know the mind inside and out because you will have confronted every aspect that holds ego into place. By the time you finish that journey, you will have seen through all of those veils. So this is, you know, when this is what makes you ready to, in the end, become a guru. You have to know all those different layers in order to work with other people. You need to be objective enough to be able to see what's coming forward and why it's in place and how to break through that, how to counsel, how to give that direction. The only way to do that is to have gone beyond it yourself. And the only way to get beyond it is to see it and confront it and then move through it so it's no longer held in place. Okay. So this is what I mean when I say you'll become familiar with the mind inside and out because you will confront all the fears, every fear that you have, every trepidation will come up in one way or another. For you to see it and confront it and cut the root of it so that it no longer grows, it no longer has a place to root. Next question. How can an unenlightened person tell if a person is enlightened or not? really almost impossible unless you're in their mind. But the best way to do it is to spend time around them, a lot of time around them, and see if their words are matching their life, if they are really not moved by these external things, if they really are in the flow, if there really is a peace and centeredness within them all the time, not just during the satsang, an hour of satsang. Anybody can be on stage for an hour. Okay. So this takes, you know, hanging out, spending a lot of time with them, really get to know what they're about. This comes in time.
Well, I would say, too, just from my own experience, the dramatic effect you've had in my personal life, it's undeniable.
Yeah, when you're around somebody that's realized or enlightened, also there's a transmission that takes place, and things will start changing in your life just by the fact of being around them. When you come into their presence, you go to deeper meditations. There's a lot of other things as well. But this takes time to get to know, you know, and figure out where this is coming from and how it's working out in your life. But you just can't walk up and look at someone and tell if they're enlightened or not, you know. I mean, you can get a little bit of clue if you can see auras and you see a big white aura around them and there are no other colors and stuff, but, you know, but not everyone is seeing auras, not everyone is, you know, is seeing that. If you see that, then it's pretty good indicator that they're pretty clear. But even then, you still need to be around and really look at what's happening.
I think that's one thing that just blew my mind when we went out to dinner. I'm like, here's all these people around here, and they don't have a clue who's in their presence. I mean, it's, you know, when we see you as a guru, then we all know who you are. But just out in regular life, people go by you, and they, except for that one child, remember there was a child that kept going by her and looking at her.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Yeah, there was one, we went out to dinner, and one little kid came by, and every time they come by me, their eyes get real big, and they just looked at me and come by again and looked at me and waving. And yeah, it was pretty cute. But yeah, there's nothing that distinguishes you from anyone else in daily life. You know, we don't float off the ground, you know, or we live life like everyone else. We eat dinner, we go to sleep, we wake up, you know. It's a normal existence, that's all. Yeah. And what remains after realization is what? Just to continue living life. Yeah. Were there any other questions? We have another question. Looks like we're going to have a short satsang and have a lot of time for meditation today. Is there a place in this center for householders versus sadhakas? What makes you think that householders are not sadhakas?
Well, I guess I have an idea of an ashram.
I need the microphone for other people to hear.
I guess I have an idea of an ashram kind of based on my experience at the Siddha Yoga Center and with Gumaraji, where, you know, there were families with children, there was daycare, you know, and I would like to see that happen, where it's not just a bunch of monks.
Well, first of all, we'd have to have an ashram anywhere. And I don't think in a beginning ashram there's really enough room to be having families living there. That would take like a larger community effort, maybe to live around there.
Yeah, I didn't mean living. I mean just families. I mean just people living normal lives that still, you know, come to the center on Sundays and are involved in the center.
Yeah, of course, you know, people can come to the center on Sundays if the children are old enough to sit and they're comprehending what they're hearing, you know, that's fine. But to bring really small children that are just disrupting things where people can't sit and meditate until there's a place for them to, you know, be able to sit and meditate themselves or whatever, then that's not beneficial.
Right. I mean, I'm just down the road. I have a vision of a, you know, sort of what the Siddha Yoga place is, where they have a child care. There's a child care.
Yeah, that would be fine, of course. That would be fine, of course. But first of all, we have to come up with some sort of an ashram, some sort of a building, some sort of a place. You know. But before we have, you know, where they're coming in for with child care and everything, I would like to have some people trained and ready, you know, that can, you know. So that's all going to come in time. But yeah, at the moment we don't have people that have young children and families, you know. But eventually, I'm sure there will be some people that may come that will have that, and then we'll put that into place when that time comes. So I thank you. There's nothing else in the satsang bowl this morning. So we will take a quick break, and we'll have more time for meditation today. We'll have a little longer meditation, an hour maybe, instead of the half hour, which is nice. Okay. So thank you. Thank you for coming. It's always good to see all of you. Namaste.